lectures. And to begin with, a couple of personal stories. A good many years ago, one evening, there was a knock on my front door. A well-dressed and suited gentleman with a briefcase stood there and announced he was selling insurance. And was I interested? Now, those of us who've been around a long time won't find this too strange, because they'll remember that door-to-door insurance selling wasn't uncommon in the past, even if it obviously doesn't happen now and hasn't for some time. So it wasn't that startling. Anyway, before I had a real chance to reply, he said, "Look, that's not the real reason I'm here. I do sell insurance, but I'm more interested in joining your party." Now, I was obviously taken aback by this, but I invited him in and we started to chat. And I got greatly enthusiastic that here was an interested person who wanted to know about the Socialist Party. So we talked. He asked me quite a few questions and I showed him examples of our literature, pamphlets especially. I remember him asking me in particular where we stood on Ireland. It was the time of the Troubles, and if we supported armed struggle. I said, of course, that we didn't, and that we didn't take sides in these kinds of things. He asked me what he needed to do to join and offered to pay a subscription there and then, but I advised him to come to our next branch meeting at the Central Library and join there. And I gave him details, and after that he left, and I was pretty pleased. Until that is, my wife, who had been in an adjacent room with the door open and had been listening to everything that was said, announced to me in a tone of certainty, "He's a policeman." Now, I'd been so absorbed in the conversation with him that such a thought had not crossed my mind. But when I started to think about it, a number of things did seem to add up. Or didn't seem to add up, depending on which way you looked at it. And even more so when he didn't come to the next branch meeting, and when I tried ringing the phone number on the business card he'd given me, it was dead. Oh, well, I didn't really know, but when I thought about it, it actually made me feel a bit scared, because he kept patting his briefcase and saying he didn't particularly like his job, but he kept the wolf from the door for him and his family. Now, I thought, what if I challenged him? Did he have some kind of weapon in his case or something? Or was that just paranoia on my part? Who knows? Oh, well, time went on. The second personal story, this, a year or two, in fact, I think maybe three. And one evening, a group of us were leafleting and selling socialist standards outside the old AEU meeting hall in Swansea, central Swansea, where a meeting had been organised by the old, people may remember it, the old International Marxist Group, IMG. We gave out the leaflets, managed to sell a few standards, at least I think we did, and then, just before the meeting was due to start, we went into the hall. As we were finding somewhere to sit down, a youngish chap in jeans and a leather jacket happened to be walking down the aisle in front of me. And he seemed to look at me. I didn't recognise him as anyone I knew, but he smiled a bit nervously and said, "I'm out of the insurance business now." Of course, I then realised who he was. I said hello to him. It became clear that he was involved with the people organising the meeting, the IMGers. So now, does adding two and two together here make four? Or does it make five or 10? Again, who knows? And the other personal story, second one, or third one, depending on which way you look at it, shorter than the first anyway. Again, a good number of years ago, Swansea Branch was holding fortnightly meetings in a room in a pub on the edge of the city centre. We were advertising the meetings via posters, leaflets, and in the local daily paper. When I arrived at the pub early for one of these meetings and stood at the bar, the landlady informed me, quite innocently, that a detective had been there asking what we were doing. thanked her for telling me and suggested that if he came again, she should tell him that our meetings were open to everyone and that he could find out what we were doing if he came along. She thanked me, and that was the last we heard of it. Okay. Now, both these events chime with conversations members sometimes had, and still have, I think, about suspicions of being spied on, either by having their telephones tapped or by someone from what is usually referred to as special branch, attending meetings covertly or even infiltrating the party by becoming members themselves. I'd always wondered about this, but I thought on balance that it was unlikely to be happening. After all, if such people had ever attended our meetings, they'd quickly find out what we were about and quickly realise that we didn't pose a threat to national security, at least in the sense that the security services understood it. I mean, it's true that in a very important sense, we are dissidents, but we've never and would never support one government or state against another and never advocate violence. So we wouldn't be involved in the kind of things likely to attract the interest of the security services. But did they know that? Well, they certainly should have done if they were doing their job properly. But listen on a bit. These incidents gave me food for thought at the time. And what now, many years later, has fed my thoughts even more is a book published just this year entitled Red List, MI5 and British Intellectuals in the 20th Century by the historian and journalist David Kaut. I don't know if you can see it there. You see it? I'm holding it in front of me, Red List. Never quite know. Of course, I see it upside down, but I think you see it in its right form, don't you? Red List, anyway, by MI5, British Intellectuals in the 20th Century by David Kaut. Well known. David Kaut, I mean. It's a book that draws on official MI5 documents that have been released to the National Archive and so are publicly available. And they provide quite startling insights into the enormous efforts and massive resources which were put into tracking the activities and affiliations of an extraordinarily wide range of people. These are people who, over much of the 20th century, were suspected of being sympathetic to or interested in regimes deemed to be enemies of the British state, or who were seen as constituting a possible threat to what was deemed to be national security. What this book shows to be the main thing that switched on the light of suspicion in the minds of MI5 or Special Branch, as its police service was actually called, was any connection whatever with the CPGB, the Communist Party of Great Britain, or anyone associated with it. Now, it's true, we all know that the CPGB was enthralled to Moscow for most of the last century and was, in effect, the British arm of the Soviet regime during most of the years it existed. And a good many of the individuals MI5 took an interest in were members of the CPGB. However, a fair number weren't, but maybe just had peripheral connections to it through being known to or friendly with CPGB members or sympathisers. And also, MI5, as the book shows, went even further than that. In fact, a lot further. They brought into their investigations any other organisations they considered potentially subversive. For example, small left-wing groups who were not actually supportive of the Stalinist Soviet regime, and some of which were, in fact, disciples of Stalin's archenemy, Trotsky. Their investigations also extended to trade unions, to anti-colonial national independence campaigners, and from the 1970s onwards, interestingly, in terms of that visit I told you about earlier, they took a close interest in the IRA. This is what emerges from this book. But in all this, there's no doubt, and this book makes that absolutely clear, that there was abject failure on the part of MI5 to distinguish between different kinds of potential subversives and the threats they might pose. So it seems quite likely that not just the CPGB and those small Trotskyist groups, but any group with the word socialist or communist in its name was being targeted, and maybe still is today. Though, as the book points out, nowadays, much more of the attention is likely to be focused on newly perceived threats to national security, such as militant Islam and maybe a resurgent non-Soviet Russia, especially in the current circumstances. But what of the Socialist Party of Great Britain and the detective asking questions in that Swansea pub? Surely anyone attending a single meeting or reading just a single party pamphlet, even a single issue of the Socialist Standard, would understand that we didn't pose an immediate, violent, non-democratic threat to the British state, but rather that our aim was to unsecretively spread socialist ideas among workers, and that with a view to a socialist society being established democratically by the ballot box, once the majority had come to understand those ideas. Okay, yes, but what emerges from this book is neither the security services nor its operatives stood out for their brightness or intelligence. The book tells stories of countless and ongoing phone taps, mail interceptions, buggings, burglaries, physical surveillance, and even infiltration by moles. But the release papers investigated by the author show that MI5 seemed to have enormous difficulty working out whether the individuals or organizations they were investigating constituted genuine, plausible threats to what was seen as national security, or whether the individuals concerned just happened to be friends or associates of members of organizations deemed suspicious and might quite innocently have found themselves in particular places at particular times. So as the book tells us, and I'm quoting here, the net cast was incredibly broad and guilt by association was paramount. And it's clear that in some cases, at least, that association was more imagined than real. So in circumstances like these, it would be hardly surprising if the Socialist Party and its members, even though we couldn't be sensibly categorized as any kind of immediate threat to national security, should have been, and maybe still are, lumped together with those who could perhaps reasonably be seen as some kind of threat, even if, of course, in reality, most of these weren't a threat either. The glaring incompetence recorded in this book is referred to by the writer with sort of typical entertaining wry commentary. He's very, very good at this. And he refers to it as, I quote, the stumbling confusion of MI5 minds. And the inevitable result of this was that most of the targeting of potential spies came to nothing, simply because they weren't spies and never constituted any feasible threat to the British state. The real spies, on the other hand, people such as Burgess, Maclean, Blunt, Filby, managed to operate for many years before their activities became known. The book suggests that the reasons for this were firstly that the lenses of MI5 were clouded because it was staffed at the top by former out-of-touch military and colonial officers. And secondly, that its agents on the ground, the special branch operatives, were simply, as I've already said, not very bright. Examples given of this is how they often included manifestly irrelevant and sometimes unintentionally comic details in their reports. So, for example, surveillance of the home of the poet C. Day Lewis produced such vital information as he seldom wears a hat and he is not altogether of smart appearance in dress. And the agent reporting from Harwich on the historian Christopher Hill, who was returning from Russia, wrote, I quote, he has the appearance of a communist, but his baggage, which was searched by HM Customs, did not contain any subversive literature. Charlie Chaplin also came under investigation, but was deemed to be, I quote, a progressive or radical rather than communist. And this, even though it was widely known, as the book points out, and I quote again, that Chaplin had long been an out-and-out fellow traveller of Stalin's Russia. So they seemed to get just about everything wrong. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the contents of the papers looked at here by David Kao also reveal MI5 culture. Did I say surprisingly? I meant unsurprisingly, reveal MI5 culture as having been highly bigoted and racist, and in particular, anti-Semitic. One memo quoted states that, again, I quote, the chief Bolshevik leaders are not Russians, but Jews who carefully hide their real names. Another report talks about a suspect's home being visited by, I quote, a number of young men who have the appearance of communist Jews. And this is one of the funniest ones, an uncle of the historian and Communist Party member, Eric Hobsbawm, most of you will have heard of him probably, is described as, I quote, sneering, half Jew in appearance, having a long nose. But the papers released only give a small taste of everything MI5 has got up to over the years. That's firstly because the records made publicly available only cover people already deceased. And secondly, because this particular book focuses only on those who are termed intellectuals, as we can see from the book's title. There we are, MI5 and British intellectuals in the 20th century. So we're looking at people such as writers, artists, scientists, historians, politicians, actors, musicians, lawyers, etc. For the most part, well-known ones. Some examples, and as I say, these are people who are well-known, most of you will certainly have heard of or know of, Benjamin Britten, Jacob Bronowski, Cecil Day Lewis, Michael Foote, Eric Hobsbawm, Doris Lessing, Ewan McColl, George Orwell, J.B. Priestley, Paul Robeson, Stephen Spender, E.P. Thompson, etc., etc. Yet, despite the 200-plus suspect intellectuals here, many other records relating to deceased individuals haven't, in fact, been released at all, so the author tells us, and without MI5 giving any reason for that. And there's also significant redaction, that is, parts hidden in some of the records that have been released. So who knows how much of the bungling, how many of the dead ends would be revealed if the totality of the security records were available, especially if they also included people who are still alive. And who knows whether, if the author of this book had cast his own net wider than just intellectuals, suspicions people from other various organizations have had about being spied in over the years would be confirmed. And who knows whether there would not be reference to the Socialist Party and any covert investigations carried out over the years on our organization and its members, living or dead. From what's revealed here, that doesn't seem at all unlikely. Suppose it should be added, however, perhaps in mitigation, if you can call it that, that all this activity was just a pale shadow of what was happening in the States, of the McCarthyite witch hunts that took place in the US in the 1950s and beyond, where intense persecution took place of anyone deemed to be or to have been in any way associated with communism. Not, of course, that this means that in Britain, despite the vast majority of MI5 spying activity leading nowhere in particular, this is not to say it didn't have negative consequences for some people, for some of those who came under suspicion. Some of them, in fact, did find it difficult to secure or to keep employment. And there were non-British subjects were sometimes denied permission to enter or to remain in the country because they were deemed to be dangerous. And in some cases, when spying was proved, prosecution did lead to prison sentences. Not in many cases, but for example, the physicist Alan Nunn May, not exactly a household name, but he was a well-known physicist at the time, who was a spy for Russia, got 10 years. He served 6.5, in fact. Right, I'm coming towards the end now, but it's worth adding two other things. Firstly, all this took place and was sanctioned under both Conservative and Labour governments. And the author highlights the particular emphasis put on this work by the immediate post-war Labour government under Attlee. So it was Attlee who, in 1947, introduced a new, more stringent vetting system. One of the results of this, perhaps ironic, was that a not insignificant number of Labour Party politicians, even leading ones such as Harold Wilson and Tony Benn, found their way onto the red list. And the author of this book has discovered that others still living still have unreleased files against their names. One example is Harriet Harman, is she the oldest Labour MP anyway? Second thing is that the BBC was complicit with MI5 as well. David Cowart dedicates a whole chapter to this. He gives it the title, The BBC Toes the Line, and illustrates how, until recent times at least, the BBC was, as he puts it, up MI5's armpit, functioning as it did as a servile collaborator of the social services, secret services. He calls it, I quote again, a semi-covert Department of State. And the BBC even carried out its own extensive vetting procedures on those within it or looking for employment in it, so as to check whether there was any sniff of subversion about them. And this kind of arse-licking led, for example, incredibly, to the BBC cancelling a planned series of radio talks on atomic power by a listed MI5 suspect, the famous scientist Jacob Bronowski. Last thing to say, and I suppose this is the possible socialist takeaway on this, is that any security setup, any spy industry, as the author calls it, involves massive expenditure of resources, both human and material. And as this book shows, MI5 was no exception to this. But this kind of waste, this kind of squandering of resources, is an inevitable function of a social system that pits capitalist classes and governments of whatever kind against one another in the battle for political and economic control of the world's resources. In the end, capitalism, whether it takes the form of state control or a relatively unfettered market, or a combination of the two, needs state secrecy to assist the national interests of each country's wealth monopolizers as they compete on the world market with their rivals elsewhere in their never-ending quest for political and economic supremacy and ultimately, as we know, for profit. Okay, that's it. I'm finished. Thanks for listening.